I'd like to welcome everybody to our ceremony this afternoon. Just quickly, Scott Bronson will be presenting the AML Awards this year. We have awards in 18 categories that only represent a fraction of the work that's been done. I mean, it's just been a very good year for Mormon Letters. We'd like to ask award winners, after you accept your award, if you're able to stay and read a short excerpt, to come sit in these first few rows on the side so you can just get up afterwards. We'll do the presentation of all the awards first and then go through the readings. So without further ado, let me actually say an opening prayer because we had a prayer request, and then we'll present the awards. Our Father in Heaven, we'd like to thank Thee that we could come together as a Mormon literature community today and acknowledge all the good work that's been done. We thank Thee for all those who have given of their time and talents, not only to pursue their own writing, but to help develop others in their writing and talents, and ask Thy blessing, especially on Rick Walton and his family at this time. And we do so in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Amen. Rick Walton is a picture book writer who's built up a lot of the picture book community. He had a tumor found a few days ago, so I think his surgery was last night, and he's hoping to be able to recover from that. And so we just had a request coming in that while everybody's here, we acknowledge and pray for Rick and Scott.
Honorary Lifetime Membership. A Lifetime Membership Award honors individuals who have given Mormon literature sustained attention and service over their careers. This year's awards honor a veteran of Mormon Letters since its renaissance in the 1960s, who has served the community as a writer, a teacher, and an editor, and a poet who has brought an impressive professional discipline to his career as a writer, teacher, and to his service as the state's poet laureate. The Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to have Karen Rosenbaum and Lance Larson join the ranks of its honorary lifetime members. Come on down. Have a seat. The Smith Pettit Award. The Smith Pettit Award, which also honors long-standing contribution to Mormon Letters, was awarded to Margaret Blair Young on Thursday for her individual efforts and for her contributions to collaborative projects. And she's not here?
No, she's in Denver.
Yeah, she didn't want to come because it's a Lifetime Achievement Award, and her lifetime is still going, so... In 2013, the Mormon comic The Garden of Enid swept all the nerdiest corners of the Mormon internet and brought us both heartache and laughter. In 2014, a comic book slipped into our Kindles and into the pews and gave us the gift of wakefulness from Sunday to Sunday. For its 2014 Comics Award, the Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor a work engaging on so many different levels that it's ideal for intergenerational sharing. Stephen Carter and Jed Atwood's Eye Plates, Volume 2. I almost said Eye Pilates.
Nah, we don't exercise.
Religious Nonfiction. Another great exploration of Scripture came to us last year in text-based nonfiction. With the possible exception of speculative fiction, Scriptures are the most read literary form in the Mormon community today, and we are pleased to be reminded last year of the spiritual fruits of taking their literary form seriously. The Association is pleased to present its 2014 Religious Nonfiction Award to Michael Austin's rereading Job, understanding the ancient world's greatest poem. Creative Nonfiction. The essays in this year's Creative Nonfiction category winner have been compared to bricks of experience, gathered together but not yet fastened down too tightly by mortar, with rapt attention to associations and absences alike. The Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor Eric Fries for his collection, Hemingway on a Bike. Criticism. At different times, literary critics have focused on the structure of texts, examined their social impact in historical context, or probed into their moral, existential, and religious implications. This year, we honor the writers, teachers, and military strategies who did all that, military strategists who did all that and more in one thoroughly readable book, Ender's World, Fresh Perspectives on the SF Classic Ender's Game. The Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor editor Orson Scott Card and the 15 contributing writers for this superb and useful work of criticism. We'll send that to him. Drama. Audiences have embraced the wit and the period spectacle of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice in a wide range of adaptations, but few of them do the thematic justice to the original text that Melissa Leilani Larson's stage adaptation delivers. Quick-moving and dazzling without glossing over the weight of questions Austen was drawn to, this script is well worthy of the Association for Mormon Letters 2014 Drama Award. This is Mel's second award in drama from the AML, correct?
Yes.
And next year she'll get one for film. Film. Most artists would love to be accused of a total lack of complacence, but not all of us have the track record for a conviction. In the latest installment of an ongoing series, writer-director Ryan Little has shown a willingness to stretch his own genre and do more with a sequel than anyone expects sequels to do. The Association for Mormon Letters finds Saints and Soldiers of the Void guilty of energy and ambition and worthy of our 2014 Film Award. Like all directors, he's on the set. Picture book. Many writers would love to influence our world, but it's likely that few do as directly as those who write for children. With Girls Who Chose God, MacArthur Krishna and Bethany Brady Spaulding have done important work shaping the sense of female agency that the next generation of LDS men and women will absorb. The Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor this book and its important cultural work. And a little addendum. At the same time, our judges' secret street-fighting alter egos have lobbied hard for The Princess in Black by Shannon Hale, Dean Hale, and Leon Pham. We'd like to recognize this sneakily charming work with an honorable mention. Middle grade novel. This year's winner in the middle grade novel category is a madcap romp of a novel in the best style of P.G. Wodehouse, a delightful mix of mystery, manners, clever girl heroines, and humor. The Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor Julie Berry and the scandalous sisterhood of Prickwillow Place. I'm here. We'd also like to give an honorable mention in the category to Anne D. Ellis and a protagonist who sucks at talking to dead people in The End or something like that. Okay. 1968. A year when the world implodes and a boy grows up. Did you get that? 575? Tell the story, Crow. Make every syllable count. The cost of our choice. Make death the backdrop. Yes, death coming up the hill. And show us the truth. AML has found its YA general novel for 2014. We are pleased to honor Chris Crow in prose as well as in haiku for his poetic novel, Death Coming Up the Hill. Young adult speculative novel. It takes more than a vividly imagined world to create a great speculative novel. Readers need characters who feel entirely real and stories that feel absolutely necessary. In the young adult speculative category, the Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor a quiet, restrained beauty of a novel about claiming one's voice and finding one's values. Ali Condi's Atlantia. Novel. 2014 was an exceptionally strong year for the Mormon novel. Works like A Song for Issy Bradley and The Bishop's Wife won praise from Mormon and non-Mormon readers alike. While Brandon Sanderson's fantasy epic Words of Radiance topped the bestseller lists. This year's winner, by contrast, appeared without much fanfare late in the year. Its author was new even to most of those who follow Mormon literature closely. Despite its unassuming debut, City of Brick and Shadows has proved itself an important contribution to Mormon letters. If Herman Melville and Jorge Luis Borges had followed two missionaries through the Brazilian underworld, they could hardly have told the story better than Tim Workus. Richly intertextual, this mystery is able to participate in its genre without being wholly of it. A landmark work that offers us a glimpse of the untapped potential of the Mormon novel, City of Brick and Shadows is our choice for the 2014 Novel Award. We would also like to issue an honorable mention for Brandon Sanderson's Words of Radiance. This second installment in the Stormlight Archive leaves us thirsty for more and marks another high point for Mormon writers layering sophisticated spiritual ideas into the very nature of the worlds their characters inhabit. For poetry and short fiction, we have two awards because we didn't get last year's done. So, 2013 award for poetry. Maybe only one who has wrestled with language as Alex Caldiero can love it as he does. Let me start again. We'll edit that out in post. Maybe only one who has wrestled with language as Alex Caldiero... Maybe only one who has wrestled with language as Alex Caldiero has can love it as he does. In Sono Suono, he forges words into a bridge across decades and an ocean to the Sicily where he grew up to listen to the voice that nurtured him there. Then returns to tell us, con voce miscato, with mixed voice, of all the wonder and longing he's experienced since. The Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor Caldiero with its 2013 Poetry Award.
Don't ever hire me to read your poetry.
Bite your tongue.
2014 Award for Poetry. When conventional forms of coping with our experiences fail, we have the option to accept shattering defeat as final or to return and recreate our worlds using new methods and molds. Kristen Eliasson's... Have I got that right? Kristen Eliasson's debut collection, Picture Dictionary, pairs image and text to breathe fresh life into an alphabet of experience, breathing redemption onto the page and into its readers. The Association for Mormon Letters is pleased to honor this careful and ambitious work with its 2014 Poetry Award. Award for Short Fiction. Take a conflict where the survival of humanity is at stake. Anchor it in questions of faith, exploring both the possibilities and consequences of attempting religious understanding between two cultures at war. And then pack it all into a short story. Brad R. Torgerson's The Chaplain's Legacy, winner of the 2013 Association for Mormon Letters Short Fiction Award. Award for Short Fiction. One role of fiction is to help us wrestle with questions that we hope never to face so forcefully in real life. Questions like, what does loyalty mean in the face of a wrenching moral dilemma? How far will we go to keep a commitment to a friend? Stephen Peck's Two Dog Dose takes us deep into difficult terrain, and in doing so, earns the honor of the 2014 AML Short Fiction Award. And that's the end of that.
I should let everybody know the boxes full of the awards are here. If you want to pack them safely for transport, you can pick up your box here. And then the boxes are now here, so it's easy.
Right.
We'd like to take the remainder of the hour, giving a chance for the winners to read. So we'll go ahead and maybe just go across rows. Do you want to start? Let me. Oh no. Boyd, how do we unblink the...
Gotta have the faith.
I've got to have the faith. There we go.
Oh, okay, you have to
and
keep
so then
coaching. Just open. Is it touch?
Yeah, here, I'll get that. There you go.
Okay, and how do I move it? Just by...
You should be able to just scroll down
okay,
like
perfect.
That. Okay.
Okay. All right. This book was written by MacArthur Krishna and Bethany Brady Spalding, and I'm the illustrator, Kathleen Peterson. They were not able to be here. They live a long ways away. So I hope I can get you excited about this book. It highlights 11 women in the Old and New Testament. This is the cover. Oh, I'm going too fast. Okay, I'm just going to show you a few of them to watch for. This one is the story of Miriam. She's a little girl, where the pharaohs. She put her mother put Moses to float in the and was found by the pharaoh's daughter. So this, I just thought, want you to know that there's a lot of thought that goes into the borders around. Those are bulrushes that you see, to read the papyrus that goes around the outside. And the bottom, I don't know if you can see it very well, are hieroglyphics that spell out the word Miriam. This is Deborah sitting under her palm tree, and there she is leading all the troops to Babel. This one is Esther, Queen Esther, appealing to the king with Persian border. This is Mary. This is the woman at the well, and here she is giving water to Jesus. This is the story of Mary and Martha, and here they are talking to, they're listening to Jesus. This is the story of the widow's mite. This is Mary Magdalene, and there she is in the garden with Jesus. And that is a painting of Eve with her children. Okay? Thank you.
When I got a bunch of copies of iPlates printed up, the printer made an error, and so I brought all the geeked copies with me, and I'll just be outside the door. And anybody who wants a geeked copy, you can have one. It's got all the same content. It's just geeked. So we're going to start. The thing that's different about this particular comic book, Book of Mormon adaptation, is that we bring in two female protagonists, and we also bring Gideon into the story early. We start with Alma getting kicked out of King Noah's court. He's out in the middle of the wilderness, and this is the part where just after he meets Sybil, who is our first female protagonist, and he's getting dragged away by this group of robed figures. And now I'm going to read this to you. He's worth how much? Shut it, Fezzik. Alma, who are you? What do you want? Who's the girl? Gideon? Clever lad. Who is she? I knew her at the palace. She was a palace girl. Lemuel's boogers. You're supposed to stay out of sight, but instead you entertain guests from the palace? What's stopping her from giving you away? This is your one chance, priest. Impress these people, all right? Believe me, you want their help. So, what do you have for us, priest? Priest, do not call me that. It reminds me of the years I spent helping King Noah drag this people into wickedness and pride. Our buildings may be beautiful, but our souls are corrupt. If we continue down this path, we'll be destroyed. Abinadi's message burns bright in my heart. This city must be saved. You're right, Gideon. This one's got the fire. And he knows the layout of the palace. And such a nice head of hair. You're all right, kid. Put her there. Sniff, sniff. We're very much looking forward to overthrowing the king with you. Just make sure to take a bath before then. So who invited you to this party? Someone with manners? Someone like a king? This one's trouble, Alma. Either you deal with her or I will. Gideon! Alma! Back off, Gideon. She's a friend. Look, buddy. Maybe she was a friend when the king wasn't after your hide. But there's a bounty on your head now. You know that, right? Because you can bet your last denying that she knows it. How seriously do you take your calling? Don't let her leave. So, you're a revolutionary now, eh? Quite a switch from last time I saw you. I don't know if I'm a revolutionary exactly, but yeah, I've definitely changed. You mind me asking? It was something Abinadi said. That there's a higher law, and that when you live it, you're filled with love instead of fear. It's like everything is washed away. I don't know if I can ever have that myself, but I at least want to tell people about it. How are you going to do that clear out here, Alma? There's not an awful lot of traffic. Good question. I'll think about it while I make a few things come to pass. Don't go anywhere, all right? Gideon will get mad. Man, those leaves were a bit insubstantial. I wonder if Sybil could pick up some toilet paper from me at the palace. Unless, of course, she brings the army back instead. I wish being a preacher with a death warrant on my head weren't so complicated. Sybil? Oh, no. Please tell me she's just using the little palace girl's room. Please, oh, please, oh, please. And then there's another 140 pages after that.
Go ahead and just pull up the chair. So I wish I had some visual to share with you, because there is sort of a VizPo aspect to Picture Dictionary that I'll just hold up for you. It's to give you a short introduction. It's in the format of a translation Japanese to English dictionary based on katakana. So we start out with the katakana syllabary in the front, and that sort of guides the overall premise of the book. And each page or each chapter essentially is a Japanese word with definitions that follow experimental prose poetry logic. So I will read 3 or 4 sections for you. Here's what this page looks like. Say, noun. Figure 127, trying to make her look at the camera. 1, back, body. His back is facing the camera. Scratch that. Your back is toward the camera, his arms bracing both of yours. He wants you to have your picture taken as much as you don't want to have your picture taken. This is relevant to the number of pictures that will eventually be replicated and left for people to take one or several, if they like, from a room of ash. The funeral lumped in a pile of names, dates, cards, pictures laced with scraps of ham and potatoes. 2. The part of the body that bears his handprint seared, sealed, and every time a little hotter, a little hotter. Try to reach. It's so hot now. 3. Height. Person. Sega takai. He is tall. In the city, wearing flats, she's easily the tallest woman by 6 inches. This is probably not true, but it feels true, and everyone is ready to accept it as fact. Say, noun. Figure 129, an unfeigned study of study, in hand, a red mechanical pencil. 1, gender or sex. 2, sexual act. A, he holds your hand in public for the first time at the National Undergraduate Literary Conference. You're wearing a pair of cream-colored slacks and a matching scarf wrapped movie star style around your hair. He loves you. B. He hands you what you realize now is the matching pencil from a set. You consider it carefully before handing it back to him, refusing to use it. And what you needed it for, you can't remember now anyway. You tell him you'll steal it, and he insists that you should have it now. Buy it, he suggests. I'll take a kiss, he says. You seal the deal. The pencil floats in the cup at the back of your desk, artifact waiting to become ash. C. This is forbidden. You are pressed upon to wait, and at least once every 4-month semester, a dark speech is given on repentance. D. Even now, you wonder if you missed your child. You don't remember him ever writing in a book, even in pencil. 3, nature, personality. You are a rotating pronoun, antagonized at every point, newly single, white, female, tall, eyes one might call lake, and drowned next to, but not in. You harbor a skeleton crew, wait to embark, embargo, trade your ribs for a title. You watch his family every day, wait carefully for you to combust. Can I do one more? Is that okay? I will reapply. Let me do one more. Shikara suru, verb. Figure 76, the shape of a plane. 1, become strong. 2, get a hold on oneself. Okinawa came on like a cold sweat. 2 stops from the monorail, there's a wet tile business hotel with a concierge who tries especially hard to learn her name, which sounds like question. In 3 days, her hair has begun falling out in handfuls again, a happy anniversary gift at the shower drain, at the corners of the carpet. She spreads the year-old pictures of him in order on a double bed that nearly fills the entire room. The archive lies quietly next to her until the morning he drowns in again. The rain shifts uncomfortably down the window, settling its tiny falls against the landscape of his birth and early childhood. She flips over his old United States Uniform Services Identification and Privilege Card. Date of birth, January 5th, 1982. Place of birth, Camp Kauai, Japan. Medical civilian expiration date. They had argued over whether to come here, married or unmarried, and if not, how they would ever manage to live their lives without screwing it up. She didn't know. And what to do now that she was here with this body of film and paper? Find the beach. Stand outside the chain link fence and imagine the inside of an old hospital. Watch the Air Force fly its planes on and off the side of the island.
So I'm going to steal a little bit of my thunder and read the end of my novel, but you've had a few months, you're not going to read it anyway, so I'll just give it to you for free. This is a novel about a girl who lives in a futuristic society. That's what I tend to write because I like world building quite a lot. But it was inspired by the Salt Lake City inversion where the pollution and we can't go outside, and I thought it's not too far to stretch that to that they would have to build an underwater city to survive because that's going to be easier than space. I did my research and I figured that out. So in this story, they're not mermaids, but they are two sisters who live underwater and one has left. And I'm going to read you the end. She's trying to find her sister throughout the whole novel, and so this will give away a little bit, but also you don't know if they're alive or dead. So I'll pretend that that's a little bit of mystique. The Sirens Island is quiet. The salty winter air feels cool, and in this season the sky's colors are softer, pink and blue. When I take off my shoes and walk on the sand with my bare feet, it feels grainy and separate instead of a smooth, warm hole. Bay waits on the island. She wraps her arms around me and pulls me close. The waves hit the shore over and over. I feel my sister's heart pounding against mine, and I close my eyes and listen. When we pull apart, I sit down on the sand, and Bay sits next to me. This may seem strange, but not to some, but not to us. The island is beautiful. More than any other place, even more than the temple, it feels like a bridge between the above and the city below. The bats that stayed above never went back to the temple. Instead, they make their homes in the caves near the sea. Sometimes, at dusk, they come out and roost in the silver-mossed trees, and I see their blue wings. And the island feels like sacred ground. Every shell in hand could hold her voice. Every stone underfoot could be where she stood. Every whisper of wind or hush of water might be a message or nothing at all. Nothing more or less than wind and waves and shells and stones. I love it here. If I could, I'd build a house out of driftwood. I would set the trident god over the lintel of the house. The bats might come to rest on him. I wish I could stay. When I was growing up, I often felt trapped by the constraints of my voice, the concerns of my family, the confines of my city. Sitting with my sister's arm around me, breathing the air of the above while the sky of the below laps at our feet, I know I am no longer trapped. I am protected, shaped and built by what is outside, what they made of me, but also by what is inside, what I made of myself. Bay, I say, speaking to her for the first time, and I see her face change, grow still, but not surprised. The wind touches her hair, blows sand along our skin. Rio, she says, your voice. I smile, she hears it too. My voice is coming back. I thought it was gone, and for weeks that was true, but then I felt it again. And I spent it all, and so was given it to share again. It made me think of my mother. She gave what she had to save others to protect and teach them, and somehow that never diminished her. Somehow that made her strong. I thought I was the last siren in Atlantia, but now I am the first. Someone has to teach the younger ones, those who have at last revealed themselves. Someone has to tell them the stories once hidden in Atlantia's walls. We ended up like our mother and her sister after all, I say to Bay, two sisters who have to live apart. I'm proud to be like them, Bay says. So am I. They kept faith with each other. Neither of them tried to destroy the other, though they could have. It is easy to see my mother and her sister in every small thing, to feel them in the open places in my soul. I think they watch us. I think they love us still. Bay wraps her arms around me, and I feel her tears on my skin. We are not lost mermaids with seaweed hair and coins for eyes, but human girls, found. We are sisters, and we did not drown.
I'm going to around the beginning of the first chapter of my novel. Years later, when he was no longer a missionary, no longer living in Villa Barbosa or anywhere near the sprawling behemoth of a city that contained it, Mike Schwartz often wondered if there was anything that he and Elder Toronto could have done to prevent the disappearance of Marco Aurelio. Surely there must have been signs suggesting that the man they had baptized was on the brink of vanishing, of, by all indications, simply ceasing to exist. On the not infrequent nights that he had trouble sleeping, Mike sat at his dining room table nursing a glass of warm milk and composing mental laundry lists of, not excuses, but factors that had stood in their way. Topping each night's list was Villa Barbosa, the dreaded neighborhood itself. Even before he was transferred there, Villa Barbosa terrified the young Elder Schwartz. A mere mention of the neighborhood's name caused his young missionary heart to speed up, his palms to sweat, his bowels to tighten and groan. As the city's most notorious slum, the neighborhood enjoyed an almost mythic status. Everyone, both Elder Schwartz's fellow missionaries and the residents of the city's other neighborhoods, had a favorite story about Villa Barbosa. For instance, an evangelical preacher denounced a handful of local criminals over the pulpit one morning, around Christmas time. The next day, the dead, mutilated bodies of the pastor, his wife, two older children, and a baby were found in front of the church, arranged in a gory nativity scene. Or this one. Over the course of a decade, a popular churrasquero kidnapped the neighborhood's poorest children, cooked them up, and served them as pork from his grilled meat carts. Or this. One hot, sweaty summer, the neighborhood's stray dogs banded together into one massive, snarling pack that roamed the dusty streets with impunity, driving the human residents into their homes for 3 days until, just as suddenly as they had joined together, the dogs disbanded and returned to their usual vagabond ways. Even if these stories were exaggerations, Elder Schwartz knew they must contain some grim truth of the terrible neighborhood. In his nightly prayers, he asked earnestly and often not to be sent.
Okay, so this is a book about Job, and I'm just going to read a couple of pages from chapter four, which is about chapter three of Job, which is where the Job narrative transfers from the sort of simplistic frame to the very difficult poem, and this is about kind of how I think we're supposed to experience that. The subtitle of the section is Patience Schmatience. Imagine that you're watching an old, silent, black and white movie with no soundtrack. The film is grainy and inconsistent, the characters are barely developed, the acting is abysmal, and you can only discern a few basic elements of the story. Then, about 10 minutes into the movie, everything changes into a high-end IMAX production with a high-resolution color video and digital surround sound. Accompanying the technical change, the acting suddenly gets good, and the characters become interesting. Though you can see that a few of the actors look a little bit like the ones in the old black-and-white movie, characters appear to have the same names, you know that you were watching a completely different movie. This is the sort of transition we are supposed to experience between the second and the third chapters of the book of Job. Job frame employs intentionally archaic language to tell an old story very simply. Its main character, Job, is flat and predictable. When he loses his children and all of his property, he just shrugs his shoulders and offers up a tepid little bit of doggerel verse. Naked came I into the world, naked will I go out of it. Glory be the name of the Lord. He completely trusts God's justice, even in the matter of whether his own children will live or die. He never once asks why he suffers. He never complains. He never expresses even a faint desire that his situation might be different than it is. When his wife urges him to blaspheme God and die, all he can say is, "Should we accept only good from God and not accept evil?" And then we switch to the IMAX version. Everything changes in chapter 3. The weak prose becomes strong poetry, the flat characters all become well-rounded and interesting, and Job, who was just singing ditties about being naked and happy, spends the entire chapter cursing his very existence. And I quote here, you can read that yourself, that he's, you know, condemning his birth and his mother's womb and her breasts and the day of his conception and wanting it all to be blotted out of the world. The parallel structure in these lines all work to intensify Job's suffering. This is an important element of Hebrew poetry that comes through in good translations. As the poem progresses, each verse tries to outdo the previous one in cursing various aspects of Job's conception and birth. The amplification goes on so long that it threatens to turn into a sort of grotesque gallows humor. Yeah, I cursed the bad reruns of MASH that made my parents go to bed early that night. But we know that Job has just lost 10 children and all of his possessions and been stricken with sores all over his body. We know that as he speaks these words, he is sitting outside and scraping himself with a jagged piece of pottery. We know we have nothing to laugh about. Job 3 is the first part of the extended dialogue between Job and his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, who have traveled from their homes to comfort him. According to the frame, they have been sitting silently for 7 full days, just commiserating with their companion. But when he begins to speak, they feel compelled to answer. And this sets up 3 rounds of speeches, 17 in all, in which Job debates his comforters about his own innocence and the meaning of his suffering. Eliphaz and Bildad speak 3 times in each portion of the poem. Zophar speaks twice, and Job speaks a total of 9 times. In each speech, Job addresses his comforters and God and demands to know the reason he has been made to suffer.
I'm just going to start at the beginning and leave it hanging so you'll actually go and read the rest of it. Jarring bang, wheels leap up, rattling a heavy load of black piping destined for the oil rig. The truck rolls on, oblivious to what it left behind. On the mattock of Coyote, from its sacrum back to its hips, its hindquarters are now flat, pressed against the pavement, its pelvis and thighs pulverized into the weight of the semi. The creature tries to pull itself forward on its front legs. It makes little progress. The spring air is cold. It's late, and the stars command a moonless sky. No car passes on this lonesome stretch of road that runs parallel to the Colorado from Highway 191 to the Potash Mine until Lauren Gumbel pulls up on the Coyote in his 94 Toyota. He shines his headlights onto the beast and sees it making an effort to move, straining against its dead back end. But its exertions fail. Lauren gets out of the truck and walks toward the Coyote. That stirs it into action, and it rises onto its front legs, snarling. Foam and blood leap from between its teeth, its eyes vicious in hatred and rage, flash red in the headlights as it struggles to pull itself forward, warning with its snapping jaws that it is not yet dead. It intends damage. Lauren hears the clatter from the truck. Abbott, an old and distinguished lad, climbs from the cab slowly. Her grizzled muzzle shows white in the backsplash of the headlights. She stands back from the commotion, hair stiff and standing along her dorsal ridge. She is giving a low rumble at the sight of her raging relative smashed bloody onto the road. Abbott, truck. Still growling low, the dog obeys. Not reluctantly, age learns its limits. The dog's human companion, too, is feeling the years press, and he stares for a time, watching the rage and vitriol of the doomed animal. He walks back to the truck and digs under the driver's seat through old pop cans, candy wrappers, and other flotsam to find the holstered 357 Smith & Wesson. It's been sequestered for a long time, yet loaded and ready for use. It feels heavy in his hand. He unholsters the gun and pops the cylinder loose and gives it a spin and sees the ends of the bullets displaying their waiting silver primer. The old dog has not watched any of this. Her eyes are exclusively focused through the front windshield on the coyote. Her intention has not wavered even for a second. The unlucky animal is laying back bound during this interlude. Lauren approaches the wounded mass in the road, and the coyote raises again onto its front legs. Its vicious rebuke is no less vigorous than before, but there is a tremor in its legs that suggests its time in this world may not be much longer. Lauren gets as close as he dares and takes aim. The savage creature is snarling and biting the air. The pistol fires and the canyon lights up from the muzzle flash like a burst from a lightning strike. Just as he pulls the trigger, however, the coyote snaps his head away and the shot strikes the beast in the muzzle. It's jerking wildly on the ground, shaking its head, trying to dislodge teeth and bones that have shattered loose in its snout. He swears. He said and steps forward, takes feather aim at Skull and fires. There is a bang and a whimper, like both scenarios for the end of the world, followed by stillness, save for the ringing in the ears from the explosion. He hears Abbott give an approving bark. He grabs the coyote by one of its front legs and swings it to the side of the road with enough force that it rolls down the embankment a bit. He goes back to the truck, takes the leather holster off the front seat, holsters the gun, and slides it back under the seat, pushing the garbage collected there out of the way. He crawls into the seat and gives Abbott's head a rub. Then grabbing the steering wheel, he looks at the large blood stain on the road. He stares long enough that Abbott fidgets with concern and begins to lick his face. He looks at Abbott, his eyes well with tears. He starts to cry. His cry is not restrained. He weeps in anguish and sorrow. Sobbing, he accepts the licks of his companion, but finds neither solace nor discontentment in the wet tongue that scours his face, for his thoughts are far away. Today, he killed not only the coyote, but murdered his best friend, Carl Tillman, and was coming out of the canyon to call the sheriff and tell Kay Tillman that her husband was dead.
Analfabetismo. You speak differently when you read than when you talk. Words move your lips in ways that defy the logic and rhythm you are used to. I clearly remember not being able to read my native language. How the language I learned to speak in school mysteriously became the one I speak every day. You speak differently when you need than when you got. Words move your lips in ways that defy the head and heart that you were born with. I clearly remember not being able to name my wants and desires. How the language I learned to speak to others mysteriously became the one I speak in my dreams. You speak differently when you talk than when you listen. Words move your lips in ways that disconnect your tongue and mouth from your breathing. I clearly remember not being able to give meaning to what I was saying. How the language I learned to speak in my head mysteriously became the one I whisper in my room. You speak differently when you think than when you know. Words move your lips in ways that resist thought and reason, and then abandon you. I clearly remember not being able to recall what was already on my mind. How the language I learned to speak in childhood mysteriously became the one I speak only to the dead. You speak differently to your own body than to the body next to you. Words move your lips in ways that are unrecognizable when you see them in the mirror. I clearly remember reaching out to reach within. How the language I learned to speak in secret mysteriously became my own scream. Thank you.
The short fiction is actually part of a much bigger story that I eventually published with Bain. I'm proud of the Chaplain's Legacy because it got way more attention than I thought it would. It was a Hugo nominee, for those that know what the Hugo is. It's a science fiction award. and it also was the reader's choice for the magazine that it was published in Analog Magazine. So I want to read you guys a very short chapter from the actual book, the novel that contains the chaplain's legacy and another short story that was part of the arc called The Chaplain's Assistant. That night I was awakened by the sound of voices, two human and one familiarly mechanical. I slowly got up out of my cot and stepped quietly to the doorway where I peered out. The professor was there and seemed to be conversing by lamplight with a man and a woman, neither of whom I recognized. "And what does immersion accomplish?" asked Phamantis. That's the aliens in the story. "It takes away the sin," said the woman. "And what is sin?" "Bad choices," said the man, "when you screw up." "Mistakes?" said the professor. "Yes," said the woman. "All of us make mistakes, all of God's children, which is why we all need his forgiveness." "And that's what the immersion in the water accomplishes," said the professor. "Yes," said the man. "It's a clean start. Once a person becomes a member." The mantis rotated his disc suddenly. He looked at the doorway. "Assistant to the chaplain, do please come out and join us." That's the protagonist he's talking to, the teller of the story. I stepped into the light, feeling stiff and frigid and wondering what time it was. The man and woman smiled at me, then returned to talking to the mantis. "So you see," she said, "nobody is cut off from his love, not even you." The professor's antenna made an ironic display. "Your human God claims to love me?" "He's not just a human God," said the man. "He's the God of all things. Ours, yours, everyone's." "I'm sorry, but the chapel is closed at night," I said gently. "We know," said the woman. We have kept the professor over at our branch house, except he practically dragged us here to talk to you." "Why did you not tell me, assistant to the chaplain, that your human God comes in different flavors?" "Flavors," I said, yawning. "Yes, and shapes. One deity, many forms. These two humans, their God is made of gold and holds a trumpet to his lips." "That's not Heavenly Father," the woman reminded the alien. "That's the angel Moroni." "Ah, I understood now. The professor had ferreted out the Latter-day Saints." "Is that where you've been all week?" I asked him. "Over with the Mormons?" "I have visited every religious structure in the valley," said the professor. "Each one seems to serve a different flavor of spirit tonight." "Oh, spirit. Tonight, I visited the Mormons." "You do not like the Mormons?" "I don't not like the Mormons. Let's put it that way," said the chaplain. I said. The chaplain himself had been a fierce Baptist, didn't think much of the whole Joseph Smith thing, or so he told me many times in confidence. Loved the people near as I could tell, but the so-called prophet? Hogwash. My dealings with the Mormons were few. They had their church, I had mine, and we operated at opposite ends of the valley. Seemed like a good fit. So what was the professor doing bringing Mormons here? We'd better go, said the man, sensing my vibe. I showed them out and returned to the lamplit altar. I have learned much, said the professor. He pointed at the altar. Here I see multiple symbols for your flavors. The star is for Jews. The cross is used by many different subdivisions of Christianity. The smaller star with the eclipsed disc is for Muslims. The fat human who laughs is the god of the Buddhists. Buddhists don't really have a god like Christians or Muslims or Jews, I said. But in the confines of this structure, you act as official for all of these, the professor said. The chaplain did, I told him. I just keep the building clean and make sure everyone knows that they can come in here during the daylight. It's what's called multi-denominational. The Mormons do not come here? Not usually. Do you compete with them for followers?
What?
The avians and amphibians. It was a major part of their society to compete for and hold adherence to a particular flavor of belief. I thought of the internecine religious struggles which plagued Earth right up to the present. I wondered if the mantis aliens hadn't already cleansed humanity's homeworld in the same manner as had been done to other species previously. Some places that happens, I said, but not here. There aren't enough of us on Purgatory, which is the planet where this is happening. There aren't enough of us that it's worth fighting each other for. The Muslims at their mosque, they told me I was the devil, said the mantis. I smiled a little bit. Some Muslims are like that. They think everyone who isn't Muslim is evil, even, sometimes, other Muslims. Then why do you have their symbol on your religious furniture? Not all Muslims go to the mosque. Some of them, the open ones, they come here sometimes. But never Mormons? Look, I don't really know what the beliefs are of the people who come to the chapel. I don't put a sign out advertising for specific faiths. Once someone keeps coming for a while, I usually talk to them and figure out what they believe. But sometimes people don't say anything at all. They come in and they sit, and whatever else they do inside their hearts and heads, well, it's not my business. Then how does one join your church? I don't have a church to join. The building, it's separate from their belief. The word church, therefore, has double meanings. My chapel just happens to serve as multiple religions. The others, the mosque, the synagogue, are each for one flavor only. Fascinating, said the professor. What's so urgent, I said, that you need to drag a couple of Mormons across the valley to talk to me in the middle of the night? Tomorrow I am bringing my students, said the professor. I already have permission from the Mormons for my students to attend their church, the Buddhists as well. Since the mosque is close to us, I ask that my students be allowed to come to you to learn Islam and Judaism and any other flavor you can show to them. What about Hinduism, I said. There's no building for this Hinduism, said the professor. Hindus, I said. They're around, though not many. Then yes, that too. Where's the chaplain when I needed him? He'd have loved an opportunity like this, a chance to illuminate the enemy, to preach the gospel among the alien heathen. But the chaplain was dead, and I was stuck in his place. I knew just enough about the major earth religions to get by, but that was all. I felt it was a serious mistake to attempt to teach any of the Mantis aliens about religions that I myself didn't understand beyond their basic precepts. But first, I needed an answer of my own. Why should I do this for you, I said, when your people plan to destroy my people? The professor considered. That is a fair question, assistant to the chaplain. Well, the logical answer is you should not. Well, if I tell you that I won't cooperate at all, unless you promise me that you're going to go to the Mantis, to this quorum that you talk about, and convince them to spare the valley. In fact, convince them to hold off on the fourth expansion, which is going to destroy humanity. Period. The professor's forelimbs made an expression of being taken aback. I'm a scholar, not a politician, he said. You ask me for things which I cannot promise and may not even be able to attempt. You told me that enough Mantis want to avoid the mistake of killing humans before you understand us. What if you talk to and convince them? How much influence does that body have? Again, you ask for that which I cannot deliver, he said. But you and your schoolmates obviously have enough leverage to get past to get at least your quorum to think twice. The professor's foreman's rattled on his dish. Agitation. No, assistant to the chaplain, I cannot do it. We're almost done. Then I won't help you, I said. In fact, I will go to the other religious leaders and I will tell all of them what I know about the genocide that is to come, and I will make this all promise together to not reveal even a single additional piece of information. This is the second time you have pretended to antagonize me, the professor said. And this is the second time I have had to remind you that I've not got anything to lose. Can you say the same? The Mantis stared at me, his beak opening ever so slightly. A flush of blue along the semi-soft portions of his carapace told me that I'd flustered him badly. He'd not expected me to bargain, only to obey. It will take time, he said. Take all the time you want. Just stop your people from killing mine. The professor stared at me, then turned his head and looked long and hard at the altar. The cross, the crescent, and the six-pointed star gleamed slightly in the wan light from the dimming oil lamps. The difficulty is great, he said hesitantly. If I return with my students, you will know your answer. And if you don't return at all, I asked, then that too will be an answer. He left as the last lamp flickered out, leaving me in cold darkness.
Ronnie, I'm a sister fellow, and Kevin O'Keefe, and I write for Actors to Perform It, but not for either of this one. Thank you, Rita, being from my practice.
Good evening. vain I have struggled. It won't do. My feelings will not be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. No one is more shocked at this turn of events than myself, especially given the very different circumstances of your family and my own. However, despite the potential degradation I might suffer, I feel compelled to express my devotion to you. I have, for some months now, endeavored to overcome my feelings, but I have failed. Therefore, I willingly surrender. And I ask that you do me the honor of accepting my hand. Miss Bennett?
You surrender?
Yes.
I am amazed. If I could feel gratitude for the expression of such feelings, I would thank you. But I cannot. I have never denied your good opinion, and you have bestowed it most unwillingly. I am sorry to have occasioned pain to anyone. It was most unconsciously done, and I hope it is of short duration.
Is this all the reply I am to have?
Your design in offending and insulting me is evident. Why else would you choose to tell me you like me against your will, against your reason, and even against your character?
Should I celebrate the lowness of your connections?
Must you go out of your way to mention it?
I only wish to be honest.
Might I do the same?
Please.
I have every reason in the world to think ill of you. Do you think that any consideration would tempt me to accept the man who's been the means of ruining, perhaps forever, the happiness of a most beloved sister? No motive can excuse the unjust and ungenerous part you acted there.
No motive but friendship.
Then you do not deny that you divided them from each other, imposing on them both misery of the acutest kind.
I have no wish to deny that I did everything in my power to separate my friend from your sister. I have been kinder to him than to myself.
Because you allowed yourself to offer your hand to someone as unworthy as I, never have I witnessed such terrible self-loathing.
You mistake.
No, I have known your true self since we first met, and my opinion of your character was further decided upon hearing the words of Mr. Ripley.
You take an eager interest in that gentleman's concern.
I know his misfortunes.
His misfortunes? Yes, they have been great indeed.
And of your affliction. You have reduced him to his present state of poverty, withholding the advantages which you must know to have been designed for him.
What was designed for him?
You have done this, yet you treat this mention of his misfortunes with contempt.
And this is your opinion of me. Thank you for explaining it so fully. My faults are heavy indeed. But perhaps these offenses might have been overlooked had not your pride...
My pride.
Had not your pride been hurt by the fact that I have misgivings about your family. Do you expect me to congratulate myself on the hope of relations whose condition in life is so decidedly beneath my own?
I might have felt some concern in refusing you had you behaved in a more gentlemanlike manner.
Miss Bennet.
You could not have made me the offer of your hand in any possible way that would have tempted me to accept it.
You have said quite enough.
I have not known you a month before I felt you were the last man in the world whom I could ever be prevailed upon to marry.
Forgive me for taking so much of your time.
Thank you to everyone. It's been a pleasure.